Warlock Holmes and the Adventure of the Three Apprentices. Once again, from the journals of Dr. John Watson. As well as I know him, I am at times uncertain how much guile I should attribute to Warlock Holmes. I know he was trying to distract me from the pursuit of the woman, but I don't know the true extent of his efforts. Let's find a case to keep Watson distracted was a plan he'd only accidentally admitted on a few occasions, but actually managed to effect. When that plan failed to distract me as long as he'd hoped, it is possible, just possible, that he elected instead for a plan of, let's find a case to get Watson horribly wounded so he can't do anything. Which he also effected, perhaps by design, perhaps by happy accident. I returned for my adventure with Violet Hunter, sure that it would be my last for some time. My right arm was badly broken. My left had been mangled by a bar guest. I had 2 cracked ribs. My leg was wounded to the bone with no small amount of attendant tendon damage. And I had crowbar marks all over my face. Plus, my screwdriver was bent. Oh, and my hair. It was a total loss. Holmes could have put it back to rights, but that would have required the use of magic, and on his advice, I thought it better to just shave it all off and begin again. Holmes was convinced it would grow back normally. I explained to him that this was not the way hair follicles worked, but he explained to me that it was the way magic did. So I let myself be overruled. To my great relief, it grew back its unaccustomed, unremarkable brown. I hesitate to think of what I'd have done to Holmes if it hadn't. To fix the rest, I summoned the best trauma surgeon I knew, James Mortimer of Dartmoor, whom you might remember from our adventure with the Baskervilles. By which I mean I sent him a letter and he agreed to come. Holmes was prepared to properly summon him out of his bath or wherever he might happen to be at that exact moment, but I insisted on normalcy, even though it hurt. Solid fellow. James hastened down by train and performed just hideously painful surgery all over me. Nevertheless, I was confident the worst was behind me, that so long as I was diligent in my efforts to recover, I should be whole again. The process was a long one. I was soon able to leave my bed, but by then my atrophied arm didn't allow me to grip anything heavier than a pencil. I could make it from my bed to the lavatory and back before my leg gave out on me, but the front door was simply beyond me. My great nemesis was the stairs. The day I finally conquered them, I had my first taste of fresh air in weeks and began a series of laughably short walks around the neighborhood. I slowly lengthened them day by day, teaching my injured limbs their old strength, such as it was. As I labored, the last days of winter and the entirety of spring fled by, and so did something else, my sense of immediacy. I should have hastened back to the game to face the woman. Instead, I allowed myself to settle into domesticity and inaction. I do not know that I would ever have deemed it was time to go forth and test myself against magic and strangeness again. But, as was often the case, adventure came and found us at 221B. Holmes and I were seated at our dining table, each absorbed in a separate discipline. By that time, I had returned to medical practice. Well, no. Let us say that some of the neighborhood vagrants had discovered that there was an underemployed medical man living near them who had no great concern over money. Thus, it had become common for me to find some ragged specimen or other collapsed in the street, always with suspicious proximity to 221B, moaning to nobody in particular that they were unable to work in their current state and that their 6 idyllic church-going children might starve if not for the timely medical intervention of a beneficent savior who would surely find his reward in heaven. Though, just as surely, said savior must be a bit of a dimwit if he thought he was going to be paid for his efforts. Thus it was that I found myself laboring to concoct a tincture for a local knife grinder's horrid footlight. I was hoping to find a way to apply it from across the room with some sort of 12-foot daubing swab. It was a difficult recipe to get right, and I would have been struggling even if it were not for the interference of Holmes. He was at that damn jigsaw puzzle again. He sat opposite me, staring at the splayed pieces with a frustration that was rapidly mounting to outright rage. He'd been at it for the last week and a half, day after day and night after night as well. He sat at our table, staring at the diverse pieces, insisting that I take my meals in some other location. Though I was glad to see him occupied, it nevertheless irked me to see him thus. I suppose I was embarrassed for him, because...
Holmes, that is a child's 24-piece puzzle. How many days do you intend to waste upon it?
Not now, Watson. I've almost cracked it.
I was inclined to be less optimistic. He yet to connect any of the pieces. Instead, they lay spread all over the table, attached to little notes which said things like green, suspiciously green, and rectangle poorly executed. Two edges are somewhat irregular. The image was of a child leading a billy goat. By the whim of chance, one piece of the puzzle featured a complete goat eye, along with one of its nostrils and just the corner of its upturned grin. This, Holmes was sure, was the ringleader to them all and possessed of a special infamy. It always had pride of place next to a note that read, "Egad, who would paint such a thing?" I was about to offer help for what must have been the 200th time, but just as I opened my mouth... This, I presumed, would be the rotten tote knife grinder, so I prepared my most professional disgust masking face and rose to answer. It wasn't him.
Nobody is here. Nobody needs to see Mr. Holmes. And I wouldn't remember if anyone was here. I fell asleep drinking my tea and slept all afternoon, didn't I? Answer the door, Warlock Holmes. Nobody needs you.
My outstretched hand stopped, hovering a few inches from the handle, and my eyes sought Holmes's. I found him utterly transformed. His gaze steely, his jaw set. Outside, I could hear Mrs. Hudson taking a few clumsy steps down the stairs. That would be the third step from the top. I heard Mrs. Hudson stumble twice on her own well-known steps. Whoever nobody might be, he presumably stood alone, just on the other side of our door.
Careful, Watson.
Maybe you should answer it.
Better if you do, Watson. I'll just be over here.
He took a position in the center of the room, staring at the door as if expecting a mortal challenge to issue through it at any moment. His weight was on the balls of his feet, and he had the unwavering focus of a gunfighter. I turned back to the door with an even more reluctant heart than I would have gathered for old Stinkfoot.
No, wait! Over here. I'll be over here.
My friend threw himself behind our sofa. For a moment, he disappeared entirely, but then his eyes peeped up over the edge, like those of a 5-year-old lad with particularly poor hide-and-seek skills.
All right, open it.
I stepped to the side and craned my hand out towards the handle, mindful of the pump crow strangling I'd received the last time this had happened.
One, two, three.
Then I flung myself away towards the corner. There in our doorway stood a gaunt gentleman with an aristocratic grandeur. He was tall, but not as tall as Holmes. He wore a black silk hat and a theatrical cape. He was pale. Age had dusted his black hair gray at the temples. He wore a mustache and goatee so sharp it looked as if the tips might double as glass cutters. A tarnished silver pentagram hung around his neck on a rough leather cord, and the buttons on his shirt were expertly wrought onyx skulls. If one walked up to one's local music hall costumer and said, "Please make me look like an evil stage magician," one could not have hoped to achieve any results superior to our guest's own appearance. Warlock's eyes widened as he popped up over the edge of the couch.
Soames? Hilton Soames?
Greetings, Warlock. May I come in?
Well, I suppose. Just this once.
Hilton Soames spared me a look of distaste and distrust as he breezed across our threshold, then turned his attention to our lodgings, gazing this way and that.
Cozy little hovel you've built for yourself, Holmes. I should have expected something of the sort.
Hey!
I rose to the safety of my chosen corner, reclaimed my position by the fire, as well as some of my dignity, I hoped.
It seems you two are acquainted.
We are.
And you must be a practitioner of magic.
Magic? A child's word for phenomena he fails to understand. I am professor of occult studies at the College of St. Luke's.
And you must be, well, evil?
Evil? How dare you? Why would you think so?
Holmes tried not to laugh. He really did make an effort. He didn't want to mock our guest, but he could not quite choke back a half-swallowed, half-spat. I looked at Holmes with a mind to chide, but in a moment I, too, was giggling. There we stood, laughing until our eyes ran, while Hilton Soames fumed.
Evil? Oh, how dare you?
Why ever would you think so?
I indicated my clothes with a faint incredulity. Finally, Holmes went to our guest and laid a comforting hand on Soames' shoulder.
Ah, really, Hilton? You must pardon my friend and me, but you see, some men hide their intentions well, and some do not.
Your buttons are skulls.
And as I have told you before, if I met a kitten with that goatee, I could not trust him. Now, I know you better than to assume this is a social call. Was there something you wanted?
Perhaps. Who is this?
Oh, it's only Watson. Anything you can say to me, you can say before him.
You trust him so perfectly, do you?
Well, perhaps I'd better say, anything you say to me, I might forget his secret and mention to Watson over breakfast. Plus, he's rather a clever fellow. Really, Soames, if you've got a problem, Watson is a most useful gentleman to have about.
I do have a problem. We may all have a problem. My carriage is just outside. Will you come to St. Luke's?
Could you, Watson?
Well, I do have one appointment, but I can hardly express how glad I'd be to skip it. So, yes.
Capital. Just let us gather our coats, Soames.
5 minutes later, the three of us were seated in a cab, bound for the College of St. Luke's. As we drove, Soames began his tale.
Have you heard of Fortescue's binding?
Not that I recall. What happened? Some fellow called Fortescue got himself tied up?
No. Penton Fortescue, a lord and preeminent occult scholar, discovered a method to summon and bind demons. Potentially quite powerful ones. The ritual was performed only once to summon three lesser demon brothers who took the names Bannister, Railing, and Low-Rising Safety Ward.
I gave Holmes a quizzical look.
Demons are weird.
The summoning was permanent. Two of the demons are dead, but Bannister has continued to serve a number of England's more prominent magical families, passed from one to another over the generations at no small expense. He has been in my service for almost 8 years now.
So, wait, are we about to meet a demon?
I'd try to manage my excitement if I were you, Watson. He can't be a very frightful fellow, or we'd have known about him before now.
Quite so. He is almost as disappointing as a demon as he is in his capacity as butler. The three were not native to this plane, and survival here did not come easy. I'm sure Bannister would be gone by now if he had not preserved himself by eating his weakening brothers.
Ugh.
I believe Lord Fortescue summoned these three weaklings to test the underlying tenets of his ritual. The binding was utterly successful. Bannister was not only bound to Fortescue, but able to be passed, like any other piece of property, from person to person. After his initial success, Fortescue retired to refine his formulas, codify what he had learned, and perfect his ritual. Unfortunately, the doddering old codger then suffered a change of heart. It seems he came to regard his own work as dangerous and unsavory. For years, it has been assumed that he destroyed all copies of his notes. The Fortescue binding has been fragmentary and incomplete.
Oh, no.
However, recently...
Oh, yes. I see what's going on.
I have, through diligent searching, reconstructed the entire ritual.
Well, of course you have. And aren't you just so pleased with yourself?
He can't be all that chuffed about it, or else he wouldn't have come to us, would he?
I'm afraid its secrecy has been compromised.
Surprise!
It is no subject for merit. I had, for some time, been instructing my three apprentices in sections of Fortescue's ritual. I had been preparing them to aid me in the summoning. But I had been careful, most careful, Holmes, that no one student should possess knowledge of the entire ritual. In fact, their knowledge was so fragmentary, so confined to that which I needed them to know, that the lads presented no threat. I myself intended to be nothing more than a responsible steward of this knowledge.
Right.
I am a simple scholar.
Oh, of course you are.
I am on the side of the angels, sir. I am at the head of a small but important school of human knowledge. I was tasked by Her Majesty Queen Victoria to extend and protect Britain's unique magical knowledge and heritage at the honored institution of St. Luke's.
Yes, I know. And I'm sure that the very instant he sees it, Wharton will agree that there is simply no possibility that St. Luke's might be Britain's foremost haven for evil wizards, or those who might wish to become one.
I am beginning to gather that impression.
Earlier this morning, the proofs of the Fortescue binding arrived from the local printer.
Wait. You sent it to a regular printer?
As I think I have said before, I am a humble university professor of limited means.
On the contrary, I think you boasted that you could afford a rather expensive demon butler.
Well, I suppose I may have forgotten to mention that banister was donated to the college. I never stated that I purchased him. And why not send the ritual to a simple printer? What harm could the man do with it? To him, it is just three sheaves of utter nonsense. To me, a treasure beyond accounting.
He's probably right about that, Wharton. So, having finished the day's advertisements about lost doggies and bicycles for sale, the local printer dashes off a copy of a lost demon-summoning ritual, delivers it to you, and then what happened?
I was so pleased at the state of the complete documents, I decided to take tea with a colleague of mine.
Decided to have a gloat, you mean?
Upon my return, just over an hour later, I was dismayed to find a key protruding from the door of my office. I had, of course, locked the room tight, knowing the value of the document that sat upon my desk. There are only two keys to that door, Holmes. One remained in my possession. The other was Bannister's.
And did the one in the door prove to be your demon butler's?
Yes. The little blighter admitted it the moment I confronted him. The reason may have been harmless enough. He says he checked in to see if I required any refreshment and forgot the key in the door.
Poorly done, Soames.
Even then, it should have been safe. Nobody knew it was there.
The printer knew. Bannister knew.
Bannister? Ha! Do you suppose I am in the habit of telling every demon I know that I'm in the possession of a demon-binding ritual? Bannister knows where the tea is kept, and that's all he needs to know. Nevertheless, this cannot change the fact that for over an hour, the Fortescue binding sat unguarded in a room that anybody might have walked into.
And you have reason to suspect somebody did, or you would not have come to seek our aid.
When I stepped back into my chambers, I realized the manuscript had been disturbed, and a token of fell intent had been left for me to discover.
Oh, I can't wait to see it. I love a good token of fell intent.
You'll not have long to wait.
He was right. St. Luke's turned out to be the smallest constituent college of the University of London. That is to say, it was so small as to be forgettable. It currently had only one teacher and three students, and its reputation was so slight, though it lay less than a mile and a half from my home, I had never heard of the thing. Really, we might have walked there. It was a pleasant day, a bit hot perhaps, but sunny and cheerful. Hilton Soames took some care to impress us as we neared his section of the grand old school.
Behold! The proving grounds of Trackenfeld, the leathern steeds of Pomel, and the black pits of shattered hopes.
By these he meant, respectively, the track field, two dusty old gymnastics pommel horses, and the long jump pit, which I had to admit was formed of an unusually dark and ill-seeming clay. From this, the listener may deduce two facts. First, that we were passing the athletics field. Second, that Hilton Soames was trying much too hard. In truth, I think he was compensating in advance. The College of St. Luke's was composed of a single gray, stumpy building. It must have been very old, certainly medieval. It consisted of a lower floor with Soames's quarters, his office, and one lecture hall. Upstairs were rooms to accommodate 8 or 9 students, but most were disused. Soames pointed out which rooms were which with the butt of his walking stick as we approached. Then he indicated the window to his office.
Oh, your desk! It's magnificent!
There seemed to be no hint of irony in his voice, so I could only assume he meant the compliment earnestly. The reason I could only assume was that Holmes was a great deal taller than I. Maybe he could see the desk in question, but I would have had to hop up on Soames's shoulders to see it through that window. As this is not the act of a gentleman, I elected to wait. Soames led us round the corner and into the College of St. Luke's. A demon took our coats, but not a very good one. To my secret disappointment, Bannister was a patently unimpressive fellow. He might easily be mistaken for a human, but not a very happy one. His face was slightly too round, too shiningly white, too doughy. His deep-sunk eyes were surrounded by bags of extreme weariness that I think no true human could match. His arms were just a few inches too long and bent with such saggy alacrity that they must either be prehensile tentacles or possessed of a few extra elbows, none of them with any strength. He had the look of a being so worn down by life that his death could not be far away, nor did it seem as if it would be particularly unwelcome. The reappearance of his master did nothing to improve the day he was having.
Bannister, this is Warlock Holmes and his colleague John Watson. Bring tea.
Bannister gave a subservient wobble and sloshed off towards the kitchen.
Useless creature!
Soames declared this before Bannister was out of earshot.
Is it usual for him to leave the key to your study in the door?
No. I cannot recall that he has ever erred so badly. Yet his entire life is one of persistent domestic deficiencies. He leaves milk out. He let the cat out one September and didn't think to look for him again until March. His memory has grown as feeble as the rest of him. If you are wondering if he could have purposely opened the door for the intruder, Dr. Watson, I assure you he could not. He is bound to my will. He must do as I bid. He answers to no other man, nor can he betray the interests of his sworn master. I think it is merely the wretched contrivance of coincidence that he should miscarry his duty on the very day of the proof's arrival. Damn it all! If I believed luck to be a living thing, a god or a demon, I would believe he hates me.
She, Soames. She hates you.
Show us the office, won't you?
Do you know, it was a nice desk. Soames had one of those huge, lovingly polished numbers all professors seem to have, for the purpose of glaring archly at students from behind it. He also had a little writing table to do actual work at. It was topped in tasteful red leather and sat near the front window, with a little chair drawn up beside it. At this table, Hilton Soames leveled one finger, shaking with theatrical dread.
Behold! The token of fell intent.
Upon the table lay a bizarre little pyramid of dark, oily earth, its surface mottled by a sprinkle of what appeared to be sawdust.
Oh, my.
Holmes was utterly charmed by it. He turned it over and about, sniffed it, shook it, and demanded that it yield all its secrets to him. It didn't. The three rolls of Fortescue's binding were scattered about the room. One lay upon Soames's monolithic desk, where he said he'd left it. Another lay on the small writing table, next to a broken nib of pencil and a few shavings. The last was face down on the windowsill.
Is that the regular position of the writing table, Mr. Soames?
No, it is usually there, near the hearth. I sometimes move it to the window if I need the light, but I will swear it was not there when I left this morning.
I think you are correct. You have been burgled. I would further suppose that this must be the first page of the binding ritual.
I indicated the Facetown sheet by the window.
That is the second.
The page upon the writing table.
And this must be the last.
The page on the desk.
You cannot possibly be able to read that text, Dr. Watson. How did you know?
Of course not. One of them is face down, so I certainly could not have read that. But I can read the situation, I think. See, your window looks down towards the entrance to this building. Your thief must have known you were gone, but dreaded your return. He took the writing desk to the window so he could watch for you while he copied it.
He copied it? Why, this is disastrous! How do you know he was not merely reading it?
He broke his pencil and paused to resharpen it.
I indicated the nib and shavings.
Yet it may be fortunate for us that he attempted a copy. If he had only read it, he might have finished the whole thing. Instead, he was interrupted before his knowledge was complete. He finished copying the first page and turned it face down, then went for the second, leaving the third still on your desk. At some point, he must have seen you returning, abandoned his task, and retreated.
Watson's getting very good at this sort of thing, isn't he?
Holmes was addressing the tiny tetrahedral lump he held in his hand.
Wrong! He could not have seen me returning from that window, for I came in through the side door. If it were my return that surprised him, it could only come as I opened the door to this very room. If that were the case, I must have seen him. There is no other exit from these chambers.
Except that one?
I indicated the officer's perfectly obvious other door.
Oh, but that's just my bedroom.
May I see it?
Soames looked annoyed, but allowed the intrusion. He had a humble room with only two pieces of furniture, though the fault of that lay squarely on Soames. Apparently, the man took such pride in his wicked sorcerer's attire that he felt he needed to fill the better half of his living quarters with the largest, most magnificent, most preposterous wardrobe I'd ever seen. His bed lay scrunched in a corner in the little remaining space. I had thought that perhaps the thief might have made his way in here and escaped through a window, but that thought was foiled. There was a window, but its latch looked to be as old as the building. It was so corroded, so crusted shut by age and oxidation, that the amount of force necessary to open it must have far exceeded the amount that would have shattered it. No thief had gone that way. I squeezed my brows together with one hand and thought. There were still so many pieces I was missing.
Want me to just call up a demon and ask what happened?
No, I forbid it. Look here, I can solve this problem, Holmes, and no sorcery will be required.
Oh? So confident, Watson?
Holmes, there are only three students, only three real suspects.
Oh, right.
It significantly limits the complexity of this case, I would think. Besides which, we have hardly begun to explore the available clues. Mr. Soames, where were you when you first suspected you'd been robbed?
In the front hall. I'd come in the side door and was approaching my office when I saw Bannister's key in the lock. I cried out in surprise, then yelled for Bannister, and we went in to see what had happened.
You waited for Bannister to arrive before you went in?
Well, I was furious with him, and I knew he could be no more than one or two rooms away.
And you say you cried out, so the thief did have warning you were returning. He must have been terrified to hear you right outside the only reasonable exit. He'd have panicked. Tell me, when you entered and discovered your proofs had been disturbed, what did you do?
I think I yelled at Bannister a fair bit. Oh, and I ran about to see if I could see who might have done it.
But you saw no one?
No.
Did you look in the bedroom?
Yes, but no one was here.
Did you happen to look in that wardrobe?
I had no chance. Bannister had some sort of fit and collapsed on the chair out there. The old fool would not get up, no matter what I did, no matter how I kicked him.
Even Holmes, who had a tendency not to care for the clues that were given him, had to raise his eyebrows at that one.
So, Bannister disobeyed your order? He shouldn't be able to do that.
Yes. Well, you've seen the beast. He's somewhat deficient. I think he was simply overcome. He knew he was in trouble.
I rather suspect Bannister might have been putting on a show to distract you from the wardrobe. Now, Soames, you left to fetch us right after that.
Yes, I had to get my own hat and cloak because Bannister was so overcome. But by the time I had them, he was on his feet and just leaving the office. I told him to lock the door and admit no one until I returned.
Well, I don't suppose he admitted anyone. In fact, I suspect just the opposite.
I went to the wardrobe and opened the door.
Huh. I've got a present for you, Holmes.
The second black pyramid was identical to the first. Holmes wasted no time snatching it from my hand and reintroducing it to his lost friend.
Look who we've found! He was hiding in the wardrobe. Oh, you must have been worried sick.
So, the entire time I was in the office...
The thief was hiding here. He must have been trapped until you left. As soon as you were gone, Bannister was free to release him. But we've got an even bigger problem.
What is that?
Is the room the same as it was when you left to fetch us?
Soames ran back into his office and searched it over.
Yes, I think so.
It must be at least an hour and a half since you left. How has the thief spent that time? He did not steal the manuscript, for there it lies. Either he must have thought he would not be caught, or he has been laying other plans.
What plans?
I have no way of knowing. The two most basic choices are either to fight us or to flee. If flight, I think he might have elected to take that manuscript with him. He may be laying an ambush for us even now. I can't be certain, but I'll tell you this. No guilty man suspects he will escape discovery when there are only two other suspects.
Indeed.
What do we do?
Well, since we've cornered ourselves in here very nicely, I'd suggest we begin by locking the door. After that, let's hear about the suspects, eh?
Soames practically tripped over himself, running to lock the office door.
There. Safe.
Well, not too safe, I should think. We know Bannister's got a key.
But he is bound to serve me.
Warlock and I exchanged a look. He nodded.
Tell me, Mr. Soames, when we walked into this building, did you or did you not tell Bannister to bring tea?
I did.
And has he?
Tilton Soames' hands were shaking visibly.
Perhaps he is receiving other orders from his true master. Speaking of which, tell us about your students.
Well, there's Miles McLaren.
What sort of fellow is he?
Bookish and weedy. A very dedicated student of magic, but a bit of an eccentric. He says he wants to make it his life's work to revolutionize personal transportation using occult study.
Let's consider his potential motives. If he had full access to that ritual, if he could summon any demon he wished, what do you think he would do?
Ha! I can tell you exactly. He'd bind the demon into a steam engine. He's certain he could make a coach-sized personal conveyance move 200 miles in a single hour without the benefit of a horse. If only he could muster the power. Mad, I tell you. He's got exactly the same delusions as that daffy Italian Ferrari.
So McLaren would happily steal the ritual to get an advantage on Ferrari, but he's not athletic.
I should say not.
Then let's move on. Are either of the others?
They both are. You should see Dalat Ross. He's quite the specimen.
Unusual name.
He was sent to us from India. He's in a Kali suicide cult. They believe that a paltry gift to their god is an insult. They therefore worked to perfect their own bodies and their knowledge before destroying themselves in her name. His athletic prowess is formidable. His academic resolve is dauntless. His love of slaughter, even self-slaughter, knows no limit. His dedication is unquestionable.
I disagree. Any member of a suicide cult who survives more than a week, well, I can't help but question their dedication. Still, it's easy to see that he might like to get his grubby little murder claws on those proofs, eh?
Absolutely. He'd use it in a second, and in the worst way he could. It's hard to get a truly powerful being through to our realm without a willing vessel. Dalat Ross would not hesitate to sacrifice himself for such an exchange. To give up his life to let a great force of destruction loose upon the world for the glory of his god.
Never mind that. How tall is he?
What? But why does that...
We haven't much time, Mr. Soames. How tall compared to me?
Oh, a beat shorter than you, I would think, Dr. Watson.
It isn't him.
Are you sure, Watson? I really think he seems like the sort of fellow...
Oh, I don't doubt it. I wouldn't be surprised if he gives us a bit of trouble in the future. Yet he does not match the particulars of this crime. The last student is both tall and athletic, I presume?
He is, but I almost hesitate to call him a student. Douglas Gilchrist is only here because he's a legacy. He's from one of England's preeminent magical families. England has several great houses with hundreds of years of bright...
Being dimwits, dodderers, and dabblers. Really, Watson, there are so few fellows worth fearing. It's an overrated field, I must say. Still, I have high hopes for young Dalat.
Be that as it may, we must disregard him for the moment. Now, Mr. Soames, what would Gilchrist do with those proofs?
Loaf about with them. Try to impress girls. Really, he is the worst, Magus. He's flirted with dismissal from this school any number of times. He cares about his cricket and rugby teams a great deal more than the arcane. He's so proud he got his blue for long jump and hurdles, but it was all I could do to get him to study his part of the ritual. His father and grandfather were foremost in the field. Indeed, his father gave me no end of trouble in my youth. But the great line has ended. Douglas Gilchrist is hopeless.
Nevertheless, he is our man.
You are sure, Watson?
I am. It all comes down to those little earthen lumps you're holding in your hand, Holmes, and to what they are really tokens of.
Fell intent.
Tilden Soames rolled his eyes at Holmes's amateurish lack of theatricality, then leaned in with the tips of his mustache quivering.
Misfortune! Calamity!
Holmes gave a hurt look for having been upstaged so cruelly, but rallied. He crooked his left hand into a claw.
Doom!
Hilton Soames grasped the corners of his long silk cape in both hands, threw his hands out to either side so he looked like some sort of goat-teed humanoid bat, and...
The death of all hopes!
Long jump, actually.
Eh?
What?
Good Lord, it's plain to see neither of you was ever a sportsman. Have neither of you ever worn track shoes? They've got spikes all over the bottom, and let me tell you, you can bang them together again and again, but you can never manage to get all the dirt out of them. Therefore, if you've been flinging yourself into a black clay jumping pit all day, you can't stop your shoes from leaving those wherever you lay them.
Aw, but that's hardly doomy at all. Are you sure about Gilchrist, Watson?
Quite sure. Remember, Soames said none of the students knew he'd printed the entire ritual. Even Bannister didn't know. So, discounting the printer, the thief must have been someone who was capable of seeing the documents through the window and also someone capable of realizing their importance. Yet, let us remember that as we approached Soames' office and approached the passes to the athletics field, only Holmes was tall enough to see the desk. The thief was therefore likely to be someone both athletic and tall. When I saw the first token, I knew I'd guessed right.
But how?
Well, think about it. Someone walks past the athletics field, sees a giant roll of parchment on your desk, and wants it. He orders Bannister to open your office.
Why do you continue to presume that someone else may command Bannister?
We shall come to it, but first let us see if the rest of the narrative suits. Having gained entrance, the thief moved the writing desk to the window, placed his spiked shoes upon it, leaving the felt token, and began to copy the manuscript, thinking he could spot your return. You took the side door, and if you had not cried out at seeing Bannister's key in the lock, you might have surprised him. Instead, your warning gave him just enough time to snatch his shoes off the desk and run to the bedroom to hide in your wardrobe, where we found the second clay pyramid. There he remained trapped until you left to fetch Holmes and me.
And you suppose Bannister let him out?
I do. It is a tenuous connection, but you mentioned that Bannister was donated by a notable magic family. I don't suppose it was the Gilchrists?
Oh! Thornton Gilchrist, I shall destroy you!
That's a yes, I should think, Watson.
He said Bannister was a peace offering. Proof that our years of antagonism were at an end. Of course, at the time, I assumed it was nothing more than a bribe to assure I would admit his useless son to this school.
It could well have been. If Gilchrist Sr. could get a still loyal Bannister and his son into your school, he'd have two spies. It would also explain why Douglas Gilchrist would attempt to copy the binding ritual, even though his own interest in magic is small.
Would it?
Of course. Never underestimate the lengths a loafabout son will go to, making sure his father's money keeps flowing in to allow him to waste his days attending university. But don't ask me how I know.
Well, then, what should we do?
Confront Gilchrist if he's still here. The problem is we've no idea what he's up to. He could have run, in which case he's got a nearly 2-hour start on us. Or he may be planning an ambush.
He might even be trying the ritual.
Do you think he's capable?
The ritual is remarkably simple. A competent mage could prepare for it in less than an hour. He is not competent, but he's had some time now.
What do you think, Holmes? Are we in any danger?
Hard to say, Watson. I imagine if he's got low ability, he's not going to be picky about particulars. He's likely to lock on to the most powerful arcane being he can find and just...
But Holmes did not finish. Instead, he blinked out of existence.
Bollocks.
Did he just... Did Holmes just... You don't think that...
Gilchrist summoned him and bound him to his will.
Could he?
I really would be the last to know. If he has, though, we've got a bit of a problem. Holmes is a most dangerous fellow.
Ha ha!
I am telling you, I've lived with the man for almost 2 years, and I've no idea what his limits might be. Perhaps he has none.
I'm sure you exaggerate.
Good. Then you may go first.
I wasn't sure what to expect. An attack by Holmes? Bannister? Gilchrist? Or perhaps only an empty school? But I certainly could never have guessed the scene that would present itself. Just opposite the door of Somers's office were the ancient stone stairs that led up to the students' quarters. At the top of these stood a flushed youth with sandy blonde hair and the easy confidence of the young and handsome. In one fist, he held a candle, in the other an irregular bundle of papers, his notes on the Fortescue binding. Just behind his right shoulder stood Bannister, looking sheepish and unhappy. Behind his left stood Warlock Holmes.
He summoned me, Watson. Me. I must say, I am flattered by the attention.
Silence! I had hoped it might not go this way, Professor. I had hoped you might never know my father had gained your secrets. But now there's nothing else for it. Minion, destroy these men.
I'd rather not, you know. I quite like one of them. But if the Master commands it, well... What else is there to do?
Yet Holmes did think of something else, something as efficacious as it was childish. He placed one foot to the small of Douglas Gilchrist's back and...
Whoopsie!
Shoved him down the stairs. I suppose most of us have fallen down a flight of stairs before. But how many have fallen down a set of steep stone medieval stairs? After seeing it happen to Gilchrist, I am not eager to ever perform the feat myself. At the top landing, Douglas Gilchrist had been a handsome, energetic man, rife with youthful vigor. By the time he arrived at the bottom, he was another fellow altogether. He had a great cut on one leg and one on his scalp. His face was bruised and puffy. Two of his fingers faced the wrong way, and the fight had gone out of him entirely.
You betrayed the master!
Bannister flung himself at Holmes.
I say, get off! Really, Bannister, this is not a fight you can win, you know.
Yet the pudgy demon would not relent. He wrapped both hands around Holmes' neck and tried to throttle him. Even from my limited vantage point, I could see there was no strength in his grip. His doughy face contorted into a hideous battle visage. Holmes looked more pitying than scared. He reached up and gave Bannister a little backhanded slap on the cheek. No sooner had Holmes' skin touched him than Bannister broke into a great cloud of white dust. Holmes was left brushing Bannister bits all off the front of his shirt as he descended the stairs.
Can't fault his devotion, can you?
Holmes, what have you done to him?
My friend gave me a quizzical look, as if it were the oddest question he'd ever heard, and indicated the white smear on the opposite wall.
But is he dead?
Watson, in our future adventures together, here is a good rule of thumb. Whenever you see anybody explode into bits and spatter all over a wall, yes, they are dead.
But how? You were bound to my will.
Don't be silly. I am not a demon, sir. I am a man. All right, I may be slightly full of demons, so I can pardon the mistake, but my will is quite my own. And let me say, even if I were a demon, I'm not sure you'd have caught me that easily. Really, Gilchrist, A little less time on the cricket pitch and a little more with your nose in the books would do you no harm, I should think. Poor marks.
Holmes stepped over the figure of young Gilchrist, then reached down and plucked the wad of paper from his grip.
I'll just be taking these, shall I? All right, Watson?
Fine, thank you.
I say, that was a refreshing little mystery. Just what was needed to ease us back into the swing of things, eh? You got a fun little puzzle to wrap your brain around with only three suspects. I got to test my mystic metal against a self-important teacher, his worst student, and an enfeebled butler demon. They won't always be such larks, you know.
Oh, I know. Our easiest case so far, by a margin, I'd say.
I suppose the only true threat was this binding ritual. Dangerous business. I'm afraid we really can't let you remember it, Gilchrist. Can we get him on his feet, Watson?
He was unsteady. We managed to raise him up, and he slumped numbly against the wall.
Any medical attention needed?
Just this, really.
I reached down, grabbed his two wayward fingers, and yanked them back into place.
Very sorry, but it's for the best, you know.
Good. Now, Gilchrist, I want you to look at me and pay attention to my words.
Holmes placed one finger against Gilchrist's bruised forehead and pushed hard.
Ow! Owie!
Cats are all carnivores, but one never ate me.
What?
Trees can't be trusted, yet they're the tallest fellows I know.
What's he doing?
I've no idea.
Verbs aren't like herbs, for they grow on the tongue. Up is a lie, but down is just the state of things. You're only feeling down because nobody's feeling you up. Had you ever never not have neglected to think of that?
Holmes and Gilchrist were gone.
Ah! What has he done? Where are they?
No idea whatsoever.
Holmes was back.
Well, that's done.
Where is Gilchrist? What have you done with him? Is he dead?
Don't be silly. I would never... He was an all right fellow, really. Sounds like his father is a bit of a pest. Yet young Douglas is nothing but a long jump enthusiast who found himself in a bit of a bad spot.
So, what did you...
I merely scrambled his memory up with a bit of good old babblemancy and sent him somewhere out of the way. You said yourself, Soames, he did not belong in a school like this. Well, I am happy to report young Gilchrist has begun anew. He is a promising young police cadet in Rhodesia.
Where?
It is a country in southern Africa.
No, it isn't.
Well, it was 20 years ago.
Nope.
Well, then, it will be within the next 20 years, certainly.
We have no way of knowing that, Holmes.
No, we do, because I tried to step straight across, you see, and I can't possibly have gotten more than 2 decades off on either side because my legs aren't that long. So if Rhodesia isn't a place and wasn't a place, then it will be, and that is where you will find Douglas Gilchrist. Oh, though from the sound of things, when we do find him, he may be somewhat younger than he ought. Sorry about that.
Impossible!
I detest the word.
Poorly done, Holmes.
Well, I had to do something, didn't I? Anyway, there's no sense worrying about it now. I say, Watson, it's a fine day. Fancy a walk home?
I'd love a breath of air. It's a bit too banistery in here.
Quite.
Who knows? You may have time to finish putting together that jigsaw puzzle.
Finish what?
Your puzzle. You may finally get it put together.
Oh, that's so much... That's all you do?
Holmes, had you not realized? Yes, you merely fit the pieces together until they make the picture on the box.
But that's so easy. That's all it takes to release its trove of secrets?
What? No, there are no secrets. No trove. It's just a picture of a boy and a goat.
That's a bit of a disappointment. Nevertheless, I shall have it completed in a day. Well, 2 days, at most. There's only one thing left to do. We have Gilchrist's copies, but not the originals. Hilton Soames, I will thank you to hand over the Fortescue's binding manuscript, if you please.
You've no right to demand it.
And yet I do demand it. You've seen what I can do, Soames. Do you suppose you have the power to keep it from me?
Soames bristled for a moment, then turned on his heel and marched into his office. He returned a moment later, holding several sheaves of paper. He brusquely deposited these in Holmes's hand.
Matters not a whit, really. I gathered the information once. It won't take me long to put it together again.
I suppose not.
Holmes took a moment to spare me a gleeful smile, then turned back to Soames with his eyes twinkling.
But I don't suppose anybody's told you cats are all carnivores, but one never ate me.
2 minutes later, we stepped out into the welcoming summer breeze.
You're sure you've taken care of it, Holmes? You're sure Hilton Soames is no threat?
Tut, Watson. I gave him a stiffer dose than young Gilchrist got. Hilton Soames has no idea there's even such a thing as magic now. He's living a cheerful new life in France as an aeroplane mechanic.
A what mechanic?
Oh, best not to worry about it. But do remind me to take good care of our timeline, won't you? If I've stranded those two in a future that doesn't end up happening, well, that would be poor form on my part.
I'm not sure I can help with such things, Holmes. Indeed, what most concerns me is that people are bound to notice the disappearance of two men and one demon butler.
Ah, hadn't thought of that. How shall we explain it, Watson?
By happy chance, the disappeared parties are the only men who can place us at St. Luke's. So, might it not be better to simply return home and make no attempt to explain anything to anybody?
An excellent solution, Watson. Oh, do you know what I've just realized? Technically, I engaged a demon in single combat today and slew him with my bare hands.
Holmes, it would be equally true to say you won a one-shot slappy fight with an aging butler.
Yes, but since it would be equally true...
Oh, very well. Single combat, bare hands.
You are a gentleman, Watson.
I am a charity.